Hello and welcome to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. I'm Naomi Fowler. Coming up later.
If you look at particular finance centers, say London and New York in particular, the problem is that the net cost of this system is quite significant. It imposes a cost not only on people who use finance, but for the whole economy.
We look at staggering figures on how the US finance sector's dragging down the economy. But first, here's a quick Tax Justice news roundup. The LuxLeaks whistleblower appeal verdict is out. Tax Justice heroes Antoine Deltour and Raphael Allais, who exposed the secret deals between multinational companies and the Luxembourg tax authorities, have received reduced, suspended sentences and fines. Although whistleblowing in the public interest was at least recognised as a legitimate action by the judge, it's still outrageous that they were ever in court in the first place, or that they should have received any penalty other than a public service award. Here's the Tax Justice Network's Alex Cobham. Still to be held accountable, PricewaterhouseCoopers, central to the whole LuxLeaks scandal. An international network of leading investigative journalists has contacted 7,000 politicians in 20 countries this month, asking them to make their tax returns public. Finance Uncovered was originally set up by the Tax Justice Network, and they're building on the inspirational work of journalist Umar Chima of the Centre for Investigative Reporting in Pakistan. He succeeded in making Pakistan the fourth country in the world to publish the tax returns of its parliamentarians. Time for other countries to follow that example. I interviewed Umar Chima in the May 2015 TaxCast edition 41. Well worth a listen. How much do countries lose in tax because of profit shifting by multinational companies? Well, the Tax Justice Network's got new research just out, estimating it at around $500 billion a year. Poorer countries suffer the most intensive losses, while the biggest losses are in the United States, estimated at $190 billion in 2013 alone. And finally, yet again, London is shamed as the centre of global sleaze and an anonymous company ownership paradise. Its banks processing nearly $740 million from a gigantic money laundering operation run by Russian criminals linked to the Russian government and the KGB. One investigator said the money was, quote, obviously either stolen or with criminal origin. Those are the news headlines. Now we're going to talk to John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network for his take on this month. OK, John, Britain is about to push the Article 50 button, which will trigger probably a two-year negotiation period, divorce proceedings for leaving the European Union. Trade in financial services is completely different to trade in things like car manufacturing and holidays. Tell us a bit about how that works.
Well, that's right. So the assumption until now has been that the City of London will have full access to trade in financial services across the rest of the European Union and will continue to do that. They'll be able to negotiate that. But it doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way because the global rules on cross-border trade, which are largely come under either the WTO, the World Trade Organization, or the General Agreement on Trade in Services, do not apply to financial services. And there's a very good reason for that, and that is because at a national level, politicians and financial regulators need to protect their domestic economies and societies from the kind of crazy financial things that banks get up to. And they talk in terms of prudentialism, that's the buzzword here, that is, we need to use our judgment to protect our domestic markets from crazy stuff happening in some other country.
And we should point out that the City of London was at the heart of the causes of the 2008 financial crash precisely because of weak regulation and dodgy things going on.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, the City of London has a trash reputation, well-deserved, a bad reputation, not only for weak regulation, but also for being a money laundering centre. And those things combined give the City of London a toxic reputation. For decades, the City of London has been the Wild West of global finance. And you talk to politicians elsewhere in the world, and they say, well, you know, we don't want that kind of nonsense because we know it will be harmful to our economies. And from that weak position, the current government in the UK has signalled that if they don't get their way in negotiations, they will take Britain further down the tax haven route. Now, of course, Britain already is a tax haven. It is already offering huge tax advantages to allow companies to shift their profits to UK. But worse, it's got heavy secrecy arrangements through its offshore satellites, which are poorly regulated and secretive, and it is itself poorly regulated. And that combination is setting up alarm bells right the way across Europe. I've just been talking with officials elsewhere in Europe, and the position is that because the government in the UK has warned that they will go down the tax haven route, they will be particularly vigilant in the negotiations to protect their domestic markets from the kind of shenanigans that happen in London.
Right, so when politicians seem to believe that financial services can be negotiated along with all the other trade deal negotiations in the same way, that's just not the case, and that may not be something that they're really getting to grips with. The default model of, you know, they tend to refer to Switzerland as an ideal. Well, Switzerland doesn't have passporting rights, and the financial services will have to establish themselves in their jurisdictions, and that would mean that they're subject to regulations which are much stricter than they are in London.
That's correct, and it's absolutely right. That's the way things should be. In international trade and financial services, a distinction is made between financial services which are relatively low risk, and that includes some kinds of specialised insurance services, some forms of deposit taking and lending, and some forms of professional investment through investment trusts and so on. There you can have genuine cross-border trade. In other words, suppliers in London can market their activities into other countries, but it's a very limited market. And that's because the regulators say all the other kind of financial services are too high risk. And so if you want to provide those financial services into our countries, you have to have a branch or some kind of establishment in our countries. And that branch will come under our financial regulation. In other words, we'll be in control. We won't let British politicians who have already signalled that they want to engage in a race to the bottom and tax haven activities. We won't allow you to operate out of London and market into our home markets, because we think that will be bad for our consumers and for our broader economy.
So the satellite havens and the City of London are quite right to be worried, but it doesn't seem like the negotiators or the politicians have quite got there yet.
I suspect that the politicians haven't realised that financial services are treated differently in international trade arrangements. There is not free trade and free access to markets for all financial services.
And the World Trade Organization rules are not going to help them here either, are they?
None whatsoever, because as I said, you know, the World Trade Organization rules don't apply to all financial services. The General Agreement on Trade and Services doesn't apply to this. If you look at some of the most recently negotiated trade agreements, the Comprehensive Economic Trade Agreement between Canada and the EU, which was signed only last year, in 2016, is perhaps one to look at. It's a very sophisticated agreement. It's known as CETA. It's a highly sophisticated trade agreement, but even there, the rights to market cross-border financial services out of Canada into the EU or out of the EU into Canada are highly restricted. They only apply to some products. All the rest still require that a Canadian bank wanting to market its complete range of services in the EU has to have a branch established in the EU, which comes under the regulatory control of the relevant authorities in the different countries where they're marketing the stuff.
So the position is getting weaker and weaker as we speak.
Yes, and I think the worst thing here is to go in naively expecting that politicians in the rest of the European Union will give in to this idea that London's regulation is equivalent to regulation in, say, Amsterdam or Paris or Frankfurt. Frankly, it isn't.
So if we were looking for the silver lining in the cloud of Brexit, in some ways it could be driving up standards. The effect on the UK could be that with a decline in those kind of services, perhaps a repositioning of the economy into more productive economic activity. I would like to hope.
Well, I'd like to hope the same thing, because I've argued for many years that Britain suffers from a finance curse. The UK's development strategy for many decades has been largely focused on developing financial services in the southeast. They've ignored production activity elsewhere in the economy. And this has been very harmful to Britain. I think if we see a rolling back of London's primacy, if we see a development strategy which takes more account of the needs of other sectors of the economy, and that will include the exchange rate adjustment that we've seen in the last year as a result of Brexit, ironically, we might see Britain move towards a more sustainable future. We might be seeing the start of the end of Britain's grip by the finance curse.
Another thing is that the UK has been blocking a lot of efforts in the European Union to bring forward better transparency in banking and finance. And the UK will no longer be able to block some of the reforms it has been blocking for a long time.
Despite all the rhetoric about Britain leading the world in transparency measures and under the previous Prime Minister, David Cameron, Britain did actually take a very interesting and progressive stance around pushing for automatic information exchange, having public reporting of company ownership on public registry and on country-by-country reporting. It was the UK government that was apparently pushing fastest in this area. But behind the rhetoric, something very interesting was happening, which was that the UK government was blocking some of the key areas where transparency is most important, particularly in respect of offshore trusts, which are the key weapons of secrecy for most of the British tax haven economy. Britain has for many decades been blocking attempts to move forward in this area. With UK no longer at the decision-making table in Brussels, it's very likely that we're going to see some progress in this area. And that's why Britain's removal from the table post-Brexit will actually allow Europe to move against some of the deep kinds of corruption that happen in tax havens. I know from a recent visit to the Channel Island of Jersey, which is a British tax haven, the people in Jersey are very scared that Britain's withdrawal from Brussels will leave them exposed to this kind of change. So I think this is a very interesting dynamic, that is that it will be possible for the EU27 countries, once Britain's no longer at the table, to move forward to strengthen transparency arrangements by moving against non-disclosure of information about trusts.
Right, and so really the satellite havens, the overseas territories and the Crown dependencies had better start looking at Plan B pretty quickly.
Well, I've argued that for many years anyway, because I think that the tax haven model needs to be closed down globally. It's causing immense damage to the entire globalisation project. It's not only damaging the rest of the world, deepening inequality across the entire world, it's also damaging their own societies. It's an extraordinary case of self-harm, because whilst some elites are doing very well in the tax havens, as we see in Britain itself, the vast majority of people are being massively disadvantaged by hosting tax havens. So this is an interesting case where a parasite is harming the host body as much as it's harming the rest of the world.
Thanks, John. John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. How many times do we hear it said that the finance sectors in our countries are powerhouses, wealth creators, the engines of growth for our economies? Well, this month, the TaxCast speaks to someone who's done the number crunching on the finance sector in the United States. He says finance in its current form is actually dragging the US economy down to a spectacular degree.
If you look at particular finance centres, say London and New York in particular, the problem is that the net cost of this system is quite significant. It imposes a cost not only on people who use finance, but for the whole economy.
This is Professor of Economics Gerald Epstein of the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He says it'd be cheaper for us to write financiers a cheque to stay at home than for them to continue as they are. Now, first of all, no one is against a healthy finance sector, but you're saying what we've got at the moment are unhealthy ones, both in the United States and in the UK and in various places elsewhere, right?
Exactly. Nobody's recommending you get rid of finance. All modern economies need a healthy financial system. So the costs and the problems that I identify are costs about the particular type and size and role of the financial system the United States and England and a few other countries has. These estimates that we developed, and they are only estimates, there's a range, it's based on the best economic research that is out there, done by a variety of economists.
Okay, and since governments deregulated banking and finance in the 1980s and took away so many checks and balances, what we've now got is supersized, highly speculative kind of casino-style finance, extracting wealth rather than creating it, and with a very firm grip on governments and policy. You could call it state capture. The Tax Justice Network calls this phenomenon the finance curse. Professor Epstein's report, Overcharged: The High Cost of High Finance, estimates that between 1990 and 2023, the financial system in the United States will impose an excess cost of as much as $22.7 trillion. For every man, woman, and child in the nation, that breaks down to between $40,000 and $70,000 each. It means, he says, finance, in its current form, is a net drag on the US economy. So, Professor, you looked at three categories to do your calculations, and we'll take these one by one. But first, let's get the costs related to the financial crisis out of the way quickly, because, yes, we all know it was an avoidable, slow-motion kind of car crash, which we're all still paying for. Now, you estimate the costs of that between $6.5 and $14.5 trillion from 2008 to 2023. And what's really interesting, though, is that even if you take away what the financial crisis in 2008 cost us, the bailouts and the lost economic output, the US financial system is still costing the US economy between $6.3 trillion and $8.2 trillion more than the benefits it provided during the period 1990 to 2005.
Right. So I think I agree with you that this is a really crucial point, because around the time of the financial crisis, people were saying, yes, of course, obviously the financial crisis is terrible and this financial system generated that, and we have to put regulations in place that will make it so that there's not going to be another financial crisis. But just the everyday, daily activities of this distorted financial system is costing our economy. So even if you don't have another financial crisis, having, you know, excess pay and profits going to the financial sector, having huge proportions of our college graduates and the cream of our youth going into finance and too much capital going into finance, all of that is costing our economies and our people on a daily, weekly, monthly basis, even if we manage to prevent future financial crises. So I agree that that's a point that really has not been adequately understood by most people and most policymakers.
Okay, and we've heard the expression privatizing the profits and socializing the losses. Some of your calculations on the cost of the financial crisis to the US economy, between $6.5 and $14.5 trillion, are based on massive underpayment, and still is, by financial services to cover their own risk taking.
Basically, these banks took on excessive risks, and that led to short-term profits. And because of the tax breaks and the bailouts that the bankers got by the Federal Reserve in the case of the United States, Bank of England in the case of England, et cetera, they didn't have to pay the downside of their profits. So in a sense, they underpaid for risk. And the Federal Reserve economists have done a number of studies which tried to calculate the difference between the rate of return that the financial sector got taking into account risk and the rate of return that it got if they didn't have to take into account the riskiness of their investments, and the rate of return that they got when they didn't have to take into account the riskiness of these investments was about double. And so we took somewhat less than that and calculated that, roughly 30 or 40% of their profits were really payments for risk that they should have deducted from their profits to compensate for risk. And so that's $2.3 trillion. And essentially this is a measure of how much they got bailed out by the central bank and the government.
Okay, let's leave the financial crisis costs behind and look at the other reasons why big finance is pulling down the US economy. Ladies and gentlemen, we give you financial sector rents. That includes excess pay, excess profits, anti-competitive practices, flogging us excessively complex and risky products, overcharging for products and services at the expense of customers and taxpayers, and fraudulent activities. Estimated total cost to the US economy? $3.6 to $4.2 trillion between 1990 and 2005. So, Professor, excess pay. Tell us about that one.
In fact, people in finance, and particularly in the highest echelons of finance, the financial engineers, the investment bankers, etc., make a significant amount more than can be explained by their productivity. There is a pay over and above that would be required to get these people to do these activities. So this is their pay over and above what they would have gotten with the same skills, experience, etc., working in the manufacturing sector and tech sector and all these other sectors in the economy.
And, ladies and gentlemen, good citizens, that leads us on to misallocation costs. When speculative finance grows too big, it strips skilled workers away from more productive employment and innovation, and it starves businesses of the credit they really need because finance is no longer interested in that kind of productivity. That has an estimated total cost to the US economy of $2.6 trillion to $3.9 trillion between 1990 and 2005.
A number of different economists have essentially just looked statistically at the relationship between the size of the financial sector in different countries and the rate of economic growth achieved over a period of time in these same different countries. And at a certain point, the financial sector, as it grows or gets bigger, is associated with a smaller rate of economic growth. So it seems like the financial sector can be too big. And most of these studies find that the turning point is when the private credit extended by the financial sector as a share of GDP is above 90 or 100% of GDP. And if it gets bigger than that, that seems to be associated with a lower economic growth. So, for example, if you take the average between 2005 and 2009, the United States' private credit to GDP ratio was almost 200%. The UK was, about 180%, so almost twice as big as GDP. Cyprus's it was over 200%, Iceland 200%, et cetera, whereas Singapore's is about 140%. So what this suggests is that if you get to have a financial system as large as ours is or as yours is, that seems to be detracting from economic growth. Now, the question is why? And economists have speculated for a while that the problem is that you get a misallocation of human and financial resources. That is, you have more and more highly skilled, highly educated people who choose to go into finance. Why? Because the pay is so high, rather than going into other economic activities, tech or doctors, other real engineers, etc., that might pay less but that are more productive and more socially productive. And similarly, you might have more of the capital of a country allocated to the financial sector than would be optimal. Now, economists don't know for sure that this is the cause of this observed phenomenon, that bigger financial systems seem to lower economic growth, but it's the most plausible explanation.
That would go some way to explaining why the US and the UK economies are kind of stagnating. So we're on a slippery slope, right? I mean, according to you, if we don't reorient our economies, we won't see the kind of growth in the productive industries that we really need.
Yeah. So what we need to think about is, you know, what are the more productive activities that ought to be substituted for these excessive aspects of finance? And so it's like, you know, coal mining in the United States. Sure, if we make the transition away from fossil fuels to green energy, there are 30,000 coal miners in the United States, which is not a huge amount, but some, who are going to lose their jobs. So what we need instead is to have an expanding industry in green energy that can employ these people. So similarly, as we shrink the financial system and reorient it, then there needs to be a substitute for other kinds of activity. Now, the reorientation in and of itself will contribute to that, because if you have fewer highly educated people spending their days trying to figure out how to speculate and figuring out how to extract more and more resources from their customers, instead of doing that, if you have them working in other industries that are more productive, that will generate more productive economic activity, both healthier and substitute economic activity for finance. But I think it is true that for those particular areas, London, New York, maybe a few other cities around the world, shrinking finance and reorienting it in this way would have short-term transitional costs.
I think the question is, can we afford not to? The problem is that both the United States and the UK seem to be going in exactly the opposite direction. So you make a lot of suggestions to address the problem of big finance, including breaking up too big to fail banks, financial transaction taxes, reducing the influence of money in politics, restructuring the finance sector, the creation of different kinds of banks for investment. It feels to me as though we're further than ever away from those kinds of goals. What's your sense?
Well, I think my response is yes and no. So the yes is the Trump administration, though it came into power in this kind of populist wave, claiming that it was going to drain the swamp and support the little person against, you know, Wall Street and the big bad capitalists, obviously is pretty much doing the opposite. And I think that with advisors from Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan and elsewhere, it's pretty clear that they're going to implement this Republican agenda of rolling back financial regulations just as far as they possibly can. So yes, at the federal level, I think things are looking very bleak. But in the United States, we have a decentralized system, so that we have states as well and local communities. And a lot of banking regulation happens at the state and local level. And I think there are a lot of initiatives in various states and local levels for more socially oriented banks, public banks, that kind of thing. So my sense is that while we're going to go very far backwards in terms of federal regulation, and by the way, this is going to affect the global regulatory scene as well, I think at the state and local level, we're going to see a lot of experimentation, a lot of movement forward, which is going to be very interesting to watch and can be very helpful at local levels, I think. In terms of the international regulatory system, I think that what's happened in the United States is that the United States is going to really pull back from promoting regulation at the Financial Stability Board and so forth, OECD elsewhere. And so this is going to help generate another kind of race to the bottom in financial regulation. And I think it's likely that elsewhere in the UK and elsewhere, they're going to follow suit. And so we're going to have not just a rollback in the United States, but perhaps globally as well, which I think is quite dangerous.
The question is, in whose interests are politicians running our countries? A few people at the top are doing incredibly well, but most of us are getting poorer. Economies in the so-called advanced capitalist nations are stagnating, and the evidence is overwhelming. We're paying a huge price for big finance. governments must now reform their financial sectors urgently. It's in the public interest, it's in the economic interest, in the global interest. Professor Epstein's report's called Overcharged, the High Cost of High Finance. Well worth a read. There's similar research going on right now into the City of London. We'll cover that on the TaxCast as soon as we can. That's it for now. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next month.